comes with a sense of commitment to life. That for me is the point, you know. So mm-hmm. last night was a great reminder of that as we sat and dialogued for about 15 minutes after the show about what the hell we're all doing here.
And did anybody have a good answer to that?
Hey, man, we're all trying to work it out.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm going to put you on the spot. Yeah. Could you give us a little bit of a via phone radio performance?
I'm Julia Kent, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Today on Wings, the cause of the people of Gaza has caught fire around the world. Africans' memories of colonization add force to their support.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The African Union has declared full support for Palestine, condemned Israel's actions in Gaza, and requested its 55 member states to end all direct and indirect trade, scientific, and cultural exchanges with Israel. But Kenya's government has pledged solidarity with Israel and met large pro-Palestine demonstrations in the capital, Nairobi, with tear gas and arrests. On January 24, 2024, hundreds of people took to the streets in Kenya's second-largest city, Mombasa, to walk for Palestine. Among them, women and children carrying placards condemning the ongoing killing. Wings correspondent Diana Wanyonyi was there.
Palestine power!
Power!
Palestine power!
Power!
My name is Sumaya Harunani, and I'm from Kenya and Palestine, Mombasa.
Reporter Diana Wanyonyi took Sumaya Harunani to a quieter spot to record what she had to say on behalf of the Mombasa chapter of the Kenya-Palestine Solidarity Movement.
Today we stand witness to an ongoing tragedy that continues to unfold before our eyes, the genocide and oppression taking place in the occupied land of Palestine. As we gather here, countless lives are being lost, families torn apart, and communities destroyed, all at the hands of those who seek to oppress and conquer. The images of suffering and despair emanating from the occupied Palestine serve as a stark reminder of the enduring human capacity for cruelty and injustice. Innocent civilians, including women and children, are subjected to unspeakable atrocities on a daily basis. Their homes are destroyed, their rights violated, and their very existence threatened by the Zionist regime. I cannot unsee a hanging half-torn body of a child. I cannot unsee a son putting the remains of his father in a plastic bag. I cannot unsee a mother looking for her daughter's hair in a pile of hair. I cannot unsee a brother carrying the dismembered leg of his baby brother. I cannot unsee a pregnant woman in Gaza being crushed to death. 75 years of illegal occupation, 75 years of oppression, 75 years of endless war crimes, 75 years of no justice, and yet we are asked, do you condemn whatever happened on October 7th? But amidst this darkness, there is also hope, a beacon of light shining brightly in the face of adversity. It is the hope embodied by those who refuse to be silenced, who continue to resist, and who stand defiant in the face of tyranny. It is the hope that springs forth from the indomitable spirit of the people determined to reclaim their dignity, freedom, and future. As we bear witness to this ongoing genocide and oppression, we must ask ourselves what will go down in the annals of history regarding our response to this heinous act. Will we stand idly by as innocent lives are lost and human rights trampled upon? Or will we rise to the challenge and stand in solidarity with the oppressed, lending our voices to their cause and demanding justice for the watermelonians? We cannot afford to be silent bystanders in the face of such injustice. We must speak out against the atrocities being committed and hold those responsible to account. We must stand united in our resolve to end the cycle of violence and oppression plaguing the occupied land of Palestine. We must work tirelessly to ensure that the voices of oppressed Palestinians are heard and their rights upheld, and we must boycott every Israeli company and product, as well as companies and products linked to this terrorist occupying Zionist regime. Boycott those celebrities who support the Zionist regime. This age of boycott encompasses both our groceries and our screens. You might wonder what difference your 100 shillings will make, but why would you want your 100 shillings to be part of the cash pile eventually used to slaughter our children, our sisters, and our brothers? In the words of Edmund Burke, the only thing necessary for triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. Let us not be counted among those who did nothing in the face of evil. Let us instead be counted among those who stood up, spoke out, and fought for justice until it was achieved. It's free Palestine until it's backwards.
Okay, you're an activist in a way.
Yeah.
As an activist, what are you afraid of?
Whatever is going on in Palestine, as an activist, as a woman activist.
Seeing the women... Okay, yeah. Seeing the women, like I said in my speech, the pregnant women, the innocent women who have lost their families, their children, their homes. Where are human rights when we need them? Where are the human? Where are the female activists? Where are the women activists when we need them? The feminists. It's all very scary.
That was Sumaya Harunani, representing the Mombasa chapter of the Kenya-Palestine Solidarity Movement at the Walk for Palestine event held in Mombasa on February 24, 2024. She spoke with Wings reporter Diana Wanyonyi. Here's more crowd sound from the event.
Down, Israel.
My name is Naomi Barasa. I'm the national chair for Kenya-Palestine Solidarity Movement. I'm based in Nairobi.
On Wings, you're listening to Diana Wanyonyi's report from a pro-Palestine demonstration in Mombasa, Kenya, held February 24, 2024. The event in Mombasa proceeded peacefully, unlike bigger demonstrations in the capital, Nairobi, which the police disrupted with force. Naomi Barasa, the national chair of the Kenya-Palestine Solidarity Movement, traveled from her home base in Nairobi to attend the Mombasa demonstration. Here she speaks to Wings reporter Diana Wanyonyi.
Kenya-Palestine Solidarity Movement is a national movement of pro-Palestine activists. The main purpose of our existence is to give solidarity to our brothers and sisters in Palestine, but to also advance activism towards the liberation of Palestine. We have been in existence for over 10 years. So being a movement, the fact that we even have chapters across the country for us is a big achievement, because for many years, the question of Palestine was not a common issue. People are not discussing it, despite the fact that the occupation and colonization has continued for 75 years. So the other achievement I would say is that now we are starting to get people to speak and people talking about the issue
openly
and breaking the propaganda that has existed and debunking the lies that have surrounded Israel and the occupation. So for us, that is a big achievement. And the fact that we are also able to influence the government of Kenya in how it participates in the geopolitics affecting Palestine and Israel, for us is a very big achievement. Like you remember, on the 10th of October, William Ruto went public on Twitter to say that Kenya is in solidarity with Israel. And we pushed back. We said, as a nation, we can't be in solidarity with Israel because we know Israel is a settler occupier and they are colonialists. And as a people who have a history of colonization and occupation, we cannot. And we pushed them. And shortly after, you realize that our ambassador at the UN, while giving the speech at a UN resolution that was calling for ceasefire, really used our language to talk about why Kenya supports the ceasefire. That's one. The other thing, all through, even where Ruto has gone, even though we don't know if he means it, but at least he has nuanced the discourse how we as Kenyans see it. He has nuanced it using our aspirations, because we feel that the foreign policy must be informed by our history.
For listeners unfamiliar with Kenya, William Ruto is the country's president. Naomi Barasa goes on to talk about Kenyan Christians' support for Israel. In many parts of the world, including the U.S., so-called Christian Zionists support and often fund Jewish settlement in Israel and occupied Palestine.
We have started even influencing Christians to look at the Israeli-Palestinian issue from a factual point of view, because Christians are so misguided by Zionism, because there's this lie that has existed for 75 years that Israel is the Holy Land. So we unpack slowly by slowly, and some Christians have already started saying that they have lived a life for a long time.
Can you speak about today demos in Mombasa?
Kenya Palestine Solidarity Movement has been organizing protests in Nairobi, Kisumu, and Mombasa. Mombasa has had about four or so. Basically, our main reason for mobilizing people in this protest is, number one, to name and shame Israel and all its supporters, including America, Germany, Canada, France, and others, to name and shame them, because the world now knows that what is going on in Palestine is human rights violation, is genocide, and this was pronounced by the highest court in the world.
To be clear, the International Court of Justice did not rule in 2024 that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. That process takes years. They did require Israel not to commit acts that contravene the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, and to punish anyone who commits such acts or encourages others to do so. They also required Israel to improve the humanitarian situation in Gaza. As of March 2024, that's not happening.
And the fact that they are not abiding by the ruling of the court, it's good enough for us to name and shame them, because they are the ones who've been advancing the human rights narrative. They are the ones who've been pushing for the never again principle after the Holocaust, but what they are committing in Palestine is exactly the same. So number one is to name and shame. But number two is to be part of the global pressure exerted to Israel and America to make sure that they pull out of Palestine, but also they end the genocide with immediate effect. And of course, to tell Joe Biden, shame on him. They cannot be the ones who are leading the UN human rights narrative yet they're the ones who are financing the war in Gaza. They cannot be the ones who tell us about children's rights, yet they are financing the war to kill children. Over 50% of the almost 40,000 people who've been killed in Gaza are women, children, and the elderly. Shame on them. They cannot be speaking from both sides of their mouth, telling us this and doing the other thing.
At our reporter's request, Naomi Barasa reads aloud the statistics issued by EuroMed Human Rights Monitor, covering 140 days of Israel's attack on Gaza, from October 7, 2023 to February 23, 2024, the day before this recording.
These statistics are very, 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 very disturbing. 38,066 people have been killed in Gaza. 14,350 are children. 8,620 are women. And out of the 38,066 people, 34,570 are civilians. So these are people who are not armed. These are people who are not in the war. So this is a targeted war against civilians. And then we have 71,220 that have been injured, a lot of them with severe injuries. There are a lot of people who have been amputated. There are a lot who have been disfigured. Out of the people who've been killed, 130 are journalists. The international law of war prohibits any protagonist against targeting journalists. But this is clear because we know they want to control the narrative. And so they've killed 130 journalists in 140 days.
In another case involving Israel, the International Court of Justice gave an advisory opinion to the United Nations in 2004 related to Israel's walling off parts of Palestinian territory in the West Bank for settlers, denying Palestinians access to necessities, including water. The court advised that Israel could not claim self-defense in that situation, as they had violated the Fourth Geneva Convention, which states that civilians in areas of armed conflict and occupied territories are to be protected from murder, torture, or brutality, and from discrimination on the basis of race, nationality, religion, or political opinion. Naomi Barasa reads more statistics.
They kill journalists and they destroy media stations, 173 press headquarters, because they don't want the world to be told the truth. They have destroyed 406 schools. They have destroyed industrial facilities, 1,920. They have damaged completely 613 mosques and damaged three churches. One of the three churches is among the oldest churches in the world. It's over 2,000 years. It's a heritage on its own. They've killed 326 medics. They've injured 430 medics. They have destroyed completely healthcare facilities, hospitals, clinics, and ambulances, 256. It is war crime to attack a hospital. It's war crime to attack an ambulance. They have bombed ambulances. They have killed the rapid responders. They have destroyed 199 heritage sites, destroyed the culture of the Palestinians, destroyed the history of the Palestinians, the artistic expression of the Palestinians, 199, some which are even protected sites. They have killed and injured civil defense workers. 184 have been killed and 143 have been injured. And they have enforced, disappeared 3,120 people. 3,120 enforced disappearances is grave human rights violation, because international law condemns enforced disappearance as a human rights violation. So if you look at every statistic here, clearly if you look at it, it does not point to anything else. It only points to grave human rights violations. It points to genocide. But most importantly, it points to huge desire for Israel to ethnically cleanse Palestine. They want to wipe out Palestine completely. They do not want to ever see Palestine under the sun. Because why would you focus so much in killing children? Why would you focus so much in killing pregnant women? Why would you bomb hospitals? Why would you switch off electricity in an ICU that harbors children that are premature? It's because they want to cleanse ethnically, completely, so that Palestine disappears in the world completely. But we thank God because the Palestinians have not been cowed down, because the world is seeing the truth, and because the one thing they have failed to destroy, they've been able to destroy everything, but the one thing they have failed to destroy, which they will not destroy, come rain, come sunshine, is the resolve for Palestine to be free. They believe Palestine will be free at whatever cost. So it's home or death, according to the Palestinians. It's home or death. Yeah.
Do you think activists in Africa and other part of the world are also doing a push for Israel to stop?
Oh, yes. There's so much pushback in Africa. States are shy of publicly coming out for Palestine, but we know a few countries that have really come out, like Tunisia, like South Africa, that have come out publicly to support Palestine. But the people of Africa, there's no doubt, we are in a Pan-African movement for Palestine, and a lot has been organized. Even this BDS movement to boycott, divest, and sanction trade and businesses for Israel is Africa-led. Of course, Palestinians are giving us a lot of support in it, but it's really Africa-led from South Africa. You have seen what the people and the state of South Africa has done for Palestine. And I can tell you there's a lot of organizing happening across Africa. It's just that the media machinery is by and large either censored by the state or owned by the state. Like if you come to Nairobi, you'd think nothing is happening in Nairobi, but there's a lot of organizing happening. People have been censored a lot. So there's a lot of organizing happening, just like there's so much organizing happening in the world. Yeah, people are organizing all over.
Yeah, I've heard you saying that in Nairobi, during demos, you're arrested, and like Mombasa. Why? Why do you think Nairobi police arrests activists during demonstrations?
I think the Mombasa community, including the leaders, have understood the Palestinian-Israeli issue very well, and therefore they know that, number one, it's not a religious issue, but number two, it's a colonizer and the colonized, and therefore they have rendered support to the discourse, especially because Mombasa is predominantly Muslim. Nairobi is predominantly Christians, and Christians are the most problematic people. I mean, Christian Zionism is so entrenched among the Christians, and so they have bought into this propaganda that this is a holy war between a holy nation and people who are standing against the holy nation. So that by itself affects a lot of organizing in Nairobi. But we are coming up because there are a lot, especially young people, who have defied that kind of teaching, and they are saying, we know the truth. While we were growing, this is what we were taught in the church, but now we know the truth. So there's a lot of organizing. That's number one. So Nairobi being predominantly Christian is problematic by itself. But secondly, a lot of Israeli investment is in Nairobi, and the government of Kenya is pro-Israel. So it is in their interest that we do not seem to be condemning Israel because of the interests they have. Number one, you know that a lot of the tear gas that we use, the same tear gas we are attacked with, is manufactured by Israel. It comes from Israel. You know very well that a lot of military weaponry in this country and in Africa largely comes from Israel. But also, Israel has one of the most advanced surveillance technology. So they are the ones who support the government to survey human rights activists that the government would like silenced. So there's a lot of interest, that's number one, in terms of technology, in terms of funding, and in terms of arms and machinery. Also remember, Israel supports a lot of African countries with this agriculture and irrigation technology. So they feel like we are going to be affecting their business interests by telling the truth about Israel. So they'd like the world and the public to remain ignorant. And for them, they have no problem if Palestine continues being oppressed as long as their business interests remain intact. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Your parting shot.
My parting shot is that we are so hopeful. We are so optimistic because we are winning this war. And we believe strongly that Palestine will be free in our lifetime. And we will visit Palestine to celebrate the liberation.
Sorry, I just have a last question, sorry. Do you have any information, or maybe has UN, UNICEF stepped in this matter of children being killed, women?
You know very well that the UN Secretary General has been saying that this is genocide and has been calling for the UN Council to act. But again, you know, America and its influence, Germany. I mean, the people, even the UN Security Council has been pushing for the resolution near ceasefire. Mm-hmm. It's been pushing for Israel going back to the 1967 border. But all this is being ignored. At one point, it is just America that is voting against. At one point, another point, it is America and the UK voting against. So we know the UN has taken a position, and a very clear position, only that they are toothless. They are toothless. They can't stand up to Israel. They can't stand up to America. But let me tell you, Israel is a stooge. Israel is a stooge of America. The reason why Israel is strong, it's because America is behind it. And they cannot stand against America.
People power!
Power!
Women power!
Power!
Youth power!
Power!
Palestine power!
Power!
Long live Palestine! Long live!
Long live!
Reporting for Wings, I am Diana Wanyonyi in Mombasa.
Down the killing stone!
Down!
Down the killing stone!
Down!
Down the genocide down!
Down!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
From the river to the sea!
Palestine!
Stop occupation!
Stop occupation!
Stop occupation!
Stop occupation!
Stop the 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 occupation now!
Diana Wanyonyi interviewed two pro-Palestine organizers at a Walk for Palestine event in Mombasa, Kenya, on February 24, 2024. Wings is a weekly radio program distributed to community radio around the world. It's been in distribution since 1986. Thanks to all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose international event series videos can be viewed at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frida Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Thursday, March 28th at La Sala Rosa, Orquesta Criminal launched a brand new album of criminal tunes sung in Yiddish, Bosnian, Greek, Arabic, Polish, Hindi, Spanish, Norwegian, and Mixteco. Orquesta Criminal is a gender-balanced 10-piece of improv performers busting out adventurous gangster songs from a dangerous and forgotten era. Thursday, March 28th, Orquesta Criminal's album launch at La Sala Rosa with special guests La Delegación. Tickets $20 in advance at casadelpopolo.com. Doors at 7. A co-presentation of Sueni Peren Popolo and CKET.
Heavy Trip and CKET present. An evening with Revenge International recording artists, Horse Lords and Colbert. A no Grammy double whammy, Chock a Block with Sonic Tomfoolery. Live at Sotrania on Saturday, March 16th. Tickets on sale now. For more information, visit www.google.com.
Hi, I'm David Suzuki, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Information to grow the brain.
The International Association of Women in Radio and Television, founded in 1949, promotes recognition, safety, and solidarity of women in journalism professions. For Women's History Month, here is a panel comprised of their members describing risks women journalists have faced for speaking truth to power.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Speaking Truth to Power was the theme of the International Association of Women in Radio and Television Conference held in Delhi, India in the fall of 2015. One panel there featured courageous women journalists who fight censorship in their own countries. Wings invited an Amsterdam-based radio producer and activist for women journalists to select excerpts from that event and put them in global context. Here's Mindy Ran.
Attacks on foreign correspondents may make world headlines, but recent research shows it's much more dangerous to be a local journalist who covers corrupt, repressive governments, criminal gangs, or big money interests. All the women you are about to hear take those kinds of risks. Their countries are officially democracies. They have constitutions and hold elections. They have both state and private media. But like a growing number of countries around the world, they also use threats and violence for media control.
We have currently more than 500 political prisoners in the country, and roughly half of them are women.
This is Ilang Ilang Quijano from the Philippines. She's the managing director and editor of a multimedia outlet for investigative journalism, Pinoy Weekly. She showed slides.
That's Sharon Cabusao. She was an officer of Gabriela, the women's movement in the Philippines. And she was our editor. And at the time of her arrest, she was also a researcher for a labor group. She's still under custody, even if they arrested her without warrant. She and her husband are detained in that small cell. It's really like a cell for dogs, you know. Another woman political prisoner, she's Andrea Rosal. She is the daughter of the late communist spokesperson. So they arrested her and they accused her of being a rebel. But her case was dismissed because they found no evidence. But what was the price? When she was arrested, she was pregnant. And then she gave birth in custody, but they didn't give her any medical attention. And what happened was her baby died. So really, it's worse than martial law, because in martial law, the older people tell us that, you know, in martial law, the women, they were always freed, you know, because of humanitarian reasons, all especially pregnant women.
The vulnerability of prisoners who are mothers is exemplified by Turkish journalist Arzu Yildiz. In May 2016, she was sentenced to 20 months in prison for reporting on alleged Turkish arms shipments to Syria. The court also stripped her of her parental rights. As of August 2016, 68 journalists are imprisoned in Turkey. China, Egypt, Eritrea, and Syria are among the current hotspots for arrests of journalists and bloggers. Death is the ultimate form of silencing. One of many women journalists killed in the Philippines was Melinda Magsino.
This is an interesting case because she was a former journalist for the Philippine Daily Inquirer. She was exposing the gambling activities of the governor of Batangas, the province she lives in. And in 2005, she went into hiding because of death threats. And then she retired from journalism. And then she got killed this year. They say that it's still because of the exposés that she did when she was a print journalist. And then when she was no longer a journalist, she continued exposing these through social media. The state forces usually try to deny that the killing is related to their work as a journalist. And they say that, oh, maybe it was because of a love angle, because she now has a new husband. For women, it's very difficult to be recognized as a journalist, even if you are killed, you know?
The worst massacre of journalists recorded to date was in the Philippines.
In the Ampatuan case, 58 people were killed. 32 of them were journalists. Some were human rights lawyers, others were civilians. The major perpetrator of the crime, it's like a warlord clan. One of them was already released on bail. And then 41 other police officers accused of the crime were released on bail. About 80 plus still remain at large. There are a total of 94 persons who were involved in the crime. And then witnesses. There have been 4 to 5 witnesses who have already been killed. The worst thing is the army officials who were involved in the massacre were promoted.
According to the International Federation of Journalists, over 2,200 journalists and media staff were killed between 1990 and 2016, 48 of them in the first half of 2016. In most cases, like the massacre in the Philippines, the vast majority of perpetrators have never been brought to trial.
It is very unfortunate in the Philippines that the killings of journalists continue under the current administration. And since 1986, there are like 174 journalists who have already been killed. So in 2013, the Philippines was ranked as the second most dangerous country for journalists, only next to Iraq. Since 1986, there have only been 11 convictions. Out of the 174 killings, only 11 convictions. And these are only the trigger men. No masterminds have ever been convicted.
That was Ilong Ilong Quijano, speaking on a panel of women journalists in September 2015. In June 2016, the incoming president of the Philippines was asked about the 176 journalists killed since his party came to power in 1986. He replied that many of them deserved to die. He went on to say, "The Constitution can't help you if you disrespect a person." Like the Philippines, the island country of Sri Lanka has ongoing ethnic and political conflicts. Their 25-year civil war officially ended in 2009, but the next government continued the power struggle through brutal media suppression.
The law seems to be of relevance to Sri Lanka, actually, for the last 5 years or so. Instead, what we had was complete and utter annihilation of the media.
Sri Lankan lawyer and media columnist Kishali Pinto Jayawardena.
the scores of killings in the northern and the eastern peninsula where the war actually took place has been legion. We have had censorship really being conformed from a matter of the law. The whole discussion and the whole struggle got transformed from that to a method of outright killings. And that transformation makes the very issue of censorship actually quite redundant. Because what do you do when, you know, your colleagues are killed? The pervasive fear that this leads to then chills every voice in the land. And I must also stress here the role played by the law in this regard. What happened was we had a whole plethora of military law, emergency law, Prevention of Terrorism Act, which were used to completely harass, intimidate, and censor journalists across the board. So at a point, you know, the military could walk into a printing press or into a publication house and just take over the entire house, take over the printing press. And nobody could challenge this in courts because the courts itself became an appendage of the political control and the political establishment. Courts also lost their independence. What was the point of my continuing in the country? It got to be so bad.
After the war ended, the president of Sri Lanka forbade investigation of war crimes and tightened his control on the media.
Pursuant to the ending of the conflict, Sri Lanka became worse. Because at least earlier we had the so-called excuse of a conflict to explain why the media was being censored or controlled. But pursuant to 2009, what happened was we had one political family controlling the entire government and controlling the entire working of the state apparatus in Sri Lanka, the Rajapaksas. The one brother was the president, all-powerful executive president. The other brother was the all-powerful secretary of defense. The other brother was the speaker of parliament. And we had scores of other relatives and cousins and whoever, you know, unknown of, unheard of people, you know, being heading all kinds of state and institutional mechanisms. And to put this in context, this was really quite unprecedented for Sri Lanka because we had had very long traditions of democracy, despite the fact that we had long-standing conflict in the country. We were not used to this kind of family aggrandizement, as it were. As a result of this transformation of the power of government, the media itself became more and more apathetic and less independent. So the state media, on the one hand, was completely taken over by the government, and we had propaganda to the extent that it was unimaginable, the state propaganda that took place. And the private media was also bought over by the Rajapaksa brothers. If you compare what the Indian media is and you compare the Sri Lankan media, you compare the Philippines media and you compare the Sri Lankan media. Sri Lanka is such a small country, you know. So when you have this corporate political control extending to almost every reach of the private media, you know, the extent to which the media collapsed in terms of its independence was enormous. On the one hand, we had this oppressive nature of the law, and then we had the method of killings and intimidation and complete fear being used by the government to censor and to threaten and control the media. And the self-censorship that took place was extremely high. There were, of course, exceptions to this rule. It was actually a joke during the repressive years that the voices speaking out against the government were really mostly women. It became quite interesting and quite amusing at a point that women commentators were actually being hailed as the people having the balls, so as to speak, in Sri Lanka. But though this picture was there of dominant female voices speaking out, in general, the control of the media was very much elite male-dominated. The presence of women, though they are in numbers, were not there in the managerial and editorial positions that one would expect. And in a sense, that lack of women editorial control was very well seen in the newsrooms and is still seen and has been the case for the last 3-4 decades, as it were.
One of the promises of the new government Sri Lanka elected in 2015 was that it would lift the bans that had been imposed against social media, especially websites of the Tamil minority. Bans on social media had not been effective in any case, as Jay Wardena explains.
We have had social media being used very effectively against the government during the last 5 years when the mainstream media could not function. In fact, social media was the reason why the Rajapaksa government was overthrown in January 2015, and also in August last month when, after years of going through this absolute terror, the Sri Lankan people overthrew this particular political family and brought in another government into power. And social media was a huge voice in that regard. But women, again, here did not play as prominent or as predominant a role as in the Philippines.
You are listening to lawyer and media columnist Kishali Pinto Jayawardena. She and other activists succeeded in getting a right to information law passed in Sri Lanka, and the previous government's website bans lifted. At the time she spoke to the International Association of Women in Radio and TV, she was skeptical that the new government of Sri Lanka would live up to its promises of media freedom. And indeed, since then, a requirement to register websites has been imposed. But she says it's not only up to the government to reform Sri Lankan media.
One of the most challenging tasks for us is to go beyond the law to see what is really wrong with us, with the media in its functioning and in its control. We have had a situation where an entire minority has been categorized as being second-class citizens in Sri Lanka by the media itself. The racism and the communalism prevalent on the part of the mainstream media has been astounding. We need to look inwards at the media and not look only at the state as a reason or as the fount or the origin of censorship.
On Wings, you're listening to voices recorded in Delhi, India, at the 36th Biennial Conference of the International Association of Women in Radio and Television. The theme of the conference was Speaking Truth to Power. Here again is producer and activist for women journalists, Mindy Ran.
According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, there were 232 journalists jailed around the world in 2012. More than half of them were sentenced under anti-terrorist laws. Continued expansion of these laws creates convenient cover for punishing journalists and forcing them to reveal their sources. But older laws are also getting brought back into play against journalists. Among these are libel, defined as a published false statement that is damaging to a person's reputation. And also sedition, which was defined in the 19th century as conduct or language inciting rebellion against a lawful government. Colonial-era sedition and seditious libel laws are still being used against journalists and netizens in India, Tanzania, Nigeria, Malaysia, and other former colonies of Britain and France. These kinds of charges can easily be corrupted to try and block criticisms of officials and companies, and they are very difficult to fight. Ilang Ilang Kihano, her father, and four other journalists were charged with criminal libel in 2004. It took them 12 years to beat the charge. Kihano's father is a physician and a professor of pharmacology and toxicology at the University of the Philippines. His research had shown that pesticides used on bananas were poisoning workers. Ilang Ilang Kihano.
I was not arrested. I turned myself in for bail because they tried to arrest my father. Me and then the editors of the paper, we paid 10,000 pesos for bail. And not many people have that kind of money. And we never got the bail back, you know, even if the charges were dismissed. And the case dragged on for 12 years. And we spent around 500,000 pesos defending ourselves for what was obviously a harassment case by a plantation. Because the evidence is very clear, you know, health poisoning, the people were getting sick, the environment was getting destroyed, and we had pictures, we had interviews, it was very well documented. And yet, the case dragged on for 12 years. It was actually dismissed by the lower court, but the owner of the company was a minister, agriculture minister, and during his time, he had the ruling reversed. It drained our resources. Of course, there are many NGOs helping us, but even ordinary citizens or journalists are sued with libel. I wonder how can they cope with such harassment suits. In the Philippines, it's really used to harass.
And then the worst thing that happened is that instead of decriminalizing libel, they actually added another form, which is online libel. The funny thing is, they call it the Cybercrime Prevention Act. And originally, it was supposed to penalize crimes that had to do with things like protecting women's and children's rights. And the thing is, it was passed without public consultation. So from before, it was 6 months, the minimum. Now it's like 6 years, and the maximum is 12 years of imprisonment.
Quijano gave examples of how the new law was abused.
See this woman in my picture? She's a teacher who just posted on social media about the mining companies, Taiwanese and Chinese mining companies, whom the mayor was involved with, and the mayor sued her, and she got detained overnight. Some nurses in Taguig who were complaining about how the hospital was being run, they were fired from their jobs. Liking a libelous post or in sharing a libelous post on Facebook means that you're aiding and abetting the crime. And they even had a takedown clause wherein if the Department of Justice sees reasonable cause for the website to be shut down, that was the takedown provision. And also it allowed for the collection of real-time data, metadata. But these clauses, these really draconian, you know, clauses, they were struck down by the Supreme Court. So that was an initial victory. And it's only because that people, the media, they really fought.
Quijano is one of the new generation of journalists who are creating their own multimedia outlets online.
We are the ones who would be the primary victims of this law because we believe that the repression of the medium is the message.
Women speaking out online, whether as journalists, bloggers, or activists, often experience abuse by trolls. Dr. Anya Kovacs directs the Internet Democracy Project in Delhi, India.
There was a case very recently of a woman called Preeta PG, who has about 17,000 followers on Facebook. She's from Kerala, a South Indian state, and she writes a lot about political issues. Sometime in July, she made some comments criticizing a Kerala politician for sexist comments he had been making. As a consequence, faced a lot of abuse. Her profile was temporarily taken down by Facebook. She managed to get that restored. Once it was restored, the former president of India, Dr. Kalam, died, who she then criticized again on Facebook, again became the victim of massive hate. There were hate pages created just to attack her. There was a page created to claim that she was a prostitute. Her son is disabled and was pulled into this as well. There were a whole number of women who responded, so she got quite a lot of online support against all of this. But about a week later, the hate pages were still on. Preeta's own page was taken down, and the profiles of a lot of the women who supported her were taken down as well. Aspects about this incident say a lot about the landscape of free speech in general. First of all is the way in which mob violence or social pressure groups can actually impose censorship without even having to use the law. It was very clear that the people who attacked Preeta did so on political grounds, and that that was why she was silenced. The second thing is that the law and police often doesn't really help. Yesterday, I came to know about journalists of Khabar Lahariya, which is a rural newspaper from Uttar Pradesh run by marginalized women, that they have been harassed on mobile phone by a stalker for about 2 months now, with multiple calls from different numbers on a daily basis. And the only thing that the police did was pass around the phone in the police station so that different policemen could talk to the abuser and basically have a joke. And the third issue is about the response of Facebook as an internet intermediary, one of the companies that actually controls a lot of these spaces. Interesting in Preeta's case is that she was not writing in English. She was writing in Malayali, a language that most people in Kerala speak and which also has a different script. Facebook claims to have community moderators, but clearly they didn't find what was going on the hate pages problematic in any way. Preeta was told that this does not violate community standards. Facebook said, because it does not come under international hate speech regulation, we cannot take it down. So the community standards basically became international law, which sees hate speech as being based on religion, nationality, and ethnic background, right? But doesn't recognize neither gender, nor disability, nor sexual orientation. Facebook refused to create a safe space for Preeta, but the profiles of Preeta and her friends were all taken down on the grounds that they did not use their real name. Preeta's last name that's on her birth certificate is not PG, it's a caste name. Using your caste name can have wider ramifications for political activists from lower castes in particular, which you do not necessarily want to face. Preeta has been in touch with Facebook, and after a lot of discussing, her profile has now been restored. She doesn't have to use her caste name for now. But the whole case raises really important questions about who Facebook will hear. The women started a campaign, so there's a hashtag for a better Facebook, both on Facebook and on Twitter, to highlight how Facebook restricts women's speech on purely commercial grounds because it's easier for them to sell advertisements if they can profile you across many different platforms. It was really interesting to see how in no time, women from across South Asia, from Africa, from the Middle East, started to say exactly the same thing. Facebook has been hearing voices from women of the West to some extent and responded to some of the issues that they face. But even in Western countries, trans women face issues with the real name policy. Native American women had been facing issues because their names were not recognized as real names by the Facebook community keepers.
One of the experiences we've had in Kenya is that when women feel violated online, instead of fighting back for their space, they actually get off the online spaces.
Rachel Nakatari, past president of the International Association of Women in Radio and TV.
One of the things we had to do was to train the police, but the police themselves are not sensitized. In fact, in Kenya, for example, we do not have very specific laws that address issues of cybersecurity. And so even when you report to the police, they're helpless. So one of the things that we have actually tried to do is to partner with the police now and get experts to train them. Because when we try to have an interview with the internet service providers, the Google, they say their allegiance is first to the customer, say they do not want to deal with the activists. They want to protect the people, you know, who are then abusing you online. So it becomes very tricky. And one of the biggest challenges that we've had is how do we deal with the borderlessness of the internet and also the anonymity, because the anonymous nature, like where we were using pseudonyms. In the Kenyan case where we've seen and where we have some examples is that when you attack the people in power and go online using pseudonyms or anonymity, then they also clear you without letting anybody know that they've done that. And we've actually lost some bloggers. Up to today, we don't know where they went. So they use the same anonymous nature of your posting against you by then clearing you without anybody knowing where you've gone to.
Sheila Dallas Katzman is the president of the U.S. chapter of the International Association of Women in Radio and TV. She thinks in terms of both inside and outside strategies.
You can talk to Facebook. IWRT has three representatives at the United Nations, and the late Catherine D. White, rest her soul, was able to bring Facebook, Twitter, Google, and have them train civil society organizations on the use of these social media platforms. So, we could invite Facebook representatives or whomever, and they will come. So, it's not that we can't get them. We must invite them and discuss with them what these problems are, because they don't even understand cultures. Look at Twitter. In Thailand, the names are so long that it's so difficult for people in Thailand to put out Twitter messages. And I want to ask you this. Do you think we can boycott Facebook? Do you think we should do that as women? Let's do that. Let's call for a day of action and shut it down for a day. Women across the world, we can do that.
For more about the International Association of Women in Radio and TV, visit the website iawrt.org. In Amsterdam, I'm Mindy Rann.
To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or visit our page at facebook.com/wingsradio. Thank you to our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Le cash, ça change le monde.
Oh, merci.
J'ai une histoire à raconter.
Un million, qu'est-ce
que tu fais? Écoute ça.
1 million.
Le cash a fait de toi ce que tu voulais. Mais le voulais-tu vraiment? Tout a une fin et un jour tu le subiras. On dirait que c'est quand tout va mal que tu laisses tomber. Mes frères qui aujourd'hui ne le fait sans mettre sans pitié. Avec une pute toujours en lutte après les stéréotypes. Quel est ton type? Ceux qui connaissent toujours à la banque ton hip. Qu'est-ce que tu disais à propos de cash? Réplique faut qu'on avec le H. Il faut
avec le cash dans l'arrache.
Ton lit est comme le cinéma. Les murs rendant une espace. Combien de temps as-tu perdu pour avoir eu un orgasme? J'réplique, j'ai de la misère à croire. Il me semble qu'il y a d'autres choses dans un affaire à bord d'un noir. Mais t'es salope à temps partiel à se faire fourrer. J'sais que ça paraît pas pour toi mais les preuves sont de mon côté. Qui a perdu ses amis? Qui est aujourd'hui seul? Il te reste le cash oublié. T'aimerais que j'ferme ma gueule.
Je rêve de rêve comme toi depuis ma tendre enfance. Puis toi tu me plaques là pour un gars de la France. Fuck that! T'as fini de me surprendre. Quand tout a débuté tu te rappelles. T'étais en bas déjà, déjà prêt à aller au ciel.
Et je t'ai reconstruit à la hauteur d'un gratte-ciel.
Après tu me lances en bas du 20ème. Ça j'ai toujours pas compris mais où est passée la flamme qui m'allumait, qui m'éclairait le chemin de la vie.
C'est que j'entendais le nom quand soufflait le vent. Je sais que j'ai pas le plus brillant mais j'ai toujours été un des plus compétents.